Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back. Simon Mundy here. This is the second part of my conversation with Jenna Ashford, the former elite hockey player turned psychologist and performance coach. And we're talking all about how to stop struggling in life to skillfully become more comfortable being uncomfortable and finding more ease and innate resilience in the process. Expect to hear lots of tools and techniques about how to drop the struggle. And we do talk about embracing being and finding peace rather than just perpetual doing in this second half, as well as Jenna's experience on her 10-day Vipassana retreat and what she learned there. There is so much good and valuable stuff throughout the entirety of this conversation. And I can assure you that if you do put some of what Jenna talks about into practice, it can be utterly transformative.
I notice I'm having the thought that I'm terrified to lose this match becomes then, okay, well, it's literally just a thought and it's one that will pass and another one will come. That's the idea of diffusion, is stepping back from it and unhooking from it or getting space from it. And there's lots of, you know, diffusion ones. There's quite fun ones in ACT, like singing the thought in a tune or saying it in a funny voice or in an accent or something. Just as a way to just take that step back and to release that fusion with the thought.
I like the one that you highlight as well of repeating the thought over and over and increasingly quickly until it basically you recognise it's just this jumble of sounds.
Yeah, so exactly. So take a word or take a phrase. And if you just, any word, I won't do it on this podcast because it'll probably drive people nuts, but just take any word and just repeat it over and over again. It becomes literally, like you say, a jumble of sounds. And then it makes us really think, well, why is this jumble of sounds having such an impact on me when it's literally just a jumble of sounds? And then, you know, put yourself into a scenario where that thought is really troubling you. And again, just, you know, repeat that over and over again. It becomes that jumble of sounds and you realize, okay, this is just a jumble of sounds. I can step back from it. It doesn't have to have this massive influence over me.
Have you heard of Michael Singer?
I have.
Wrote The Untethered Soul and The Surrender Experiment. And he's a bit more of a spiritual type, although, again, I do think that ACT and that, there's not a huge difference, really. It's just ACT is like a gateway drug. And he says the whole spiritual game is making the gap between you and your thoughts bigger. And that's exactly what this is doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the Untethered Soul's a great book, but it is. It's just creating that space, creating that space. And I mean, you know, you watch someone like, let's just go back to Djokovic, because he is such a good example of it. And I'm sure, you know, like he says, it's something that he's learned. So it's not like he was born with this ability, but just to create that space between points, just to, okay, you know, and you can kind of see it in his body language, you can see it in his demeanor, that is exactly it. To then recognize that we have a space and then recognize that we have a choice. And the choice is how we act and behave. It's not in what thought comes next. So that, you know, that's another big focus of ACT, is focusing on actions and behaviors rather than trying to control what you're thinking.
Yeah, doing what you need to do irrespective of your thoughts and feelings, basically. Exactly. Yeah, we'll come to that. But you said, what are thoughts? And I thought this was such a interesting thing to point out, because I'm sure that, well, no one can answer that, right? And actually, it's not even just thoughts. I was thinking about this, like feelings as well. Okay, if you really go into a feeling of, let's say, excitement or anxiety, you go into it, it's just this sort of tingly, amorphous cloud floating in something. And the same, even you can go out into perceptions as well, but you know, that's getting a bit deep. But like, let's stick with thoughts, because I do think it's such an interesting question. So when you put this in the book, or when you pose this to people, is this another one they're like, oh yeah, like Christ, what are they?
Yeah, totally. And then I think, you know, once you then can't quite define it, and then you see how much of an impact your thoughts are having on you, it's like, well, yeah, I don't even know what these things are, and yet they're ruling my life.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, again, it's that moment of like, they don't have to rule me. I don't have to believe or buy into all of them. A lot of what our mind is telling us is, you know, a load of drivel, or stuff that's not even going to happen, or stuff that hasn't happened, and we're just imagining it, you know. So that's exactly it. I think it's just helping people to recognize that thoughts are just whatever, images, memories, sensations, whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, passing through your mind, and that they come and go, and they always will come and go, and that we don't have to be beholden to them.
And most people tend to think that they are their thoughts, at least to some degree. You know, if you ask someone who they are, they'll give you a list of concepts. You know, even a parent, right? It's a concept fundamentally. Obviously, it points to something, but it's still a concept. And yet pretty much everyone defines themselves through the thoughts they have, and take that to be who they are, when in actually it's just, as you say, sounds, images, and then concepts pointing to something that we've kind of collectively agreed upon.
Well, it's exactly, and that's you can't blame people, right? It's how society, it's how you know, unless you live in a monastery in Tibet where, you know, things are very different, it is just the way that society is. So but again, it's just amazing to step back, to recognize it, to see it, and then, you know, to think about, right, what direction do I want to head in here? How do I want to define myself? You know, what even is myself?
yeah. Okay, we'll come to that later. Yeah. But so Djokovic obviously has trained himself in, for example, mindful breathing, and it's definitely made him very tough on court. To go to a much lower level myself, like when I did the Jon Kabat-Zinn 8-week mindfulness course, so meditating, that was probably the most intense period of meditation I've had. And I definitely noticed I was able to be more responsive and less reactive, for example. And I know that you've done more hardcore meditation than me, and I want to quiz you about that in a bit. But just briefly, how much of an impact did that have, or does your ongoing practice, if you have one, have on that ability to widen that gap?
Yeah, I think it's enormously helpful, because and you know describe, you use the word dedicated. I think it's enormously helpful to have some dedicated time to this, because we are busy, right? I mean, there's just loads of things going on, and it's very easy to understand it intellectually. You know, people might listen to this podcast and get it, they might read a book and get it, but unless you practice or experience it, that's the whole nother kind of level. So I think what I'd definitely say is, you know, step one is understanding it, of course, intellectually, but you've got to take that to a level of experience and seeing for yourself what it feels like, in a way that sometimes you almost can't describe, but you just, in your body, in you know it, you feel it. Like you say, just to help to create that separation. I think you don't have to do hardcore. You don't have to do an 8-week thing. You can do a little and often, but something is better than nothing in terms of just appreciating that space.
What's your daily practice? Because I know you're a busy woman and you've got a bubby. So do you still sit daily?
Yeah, so I don't sit for long periods of time. I love headspace. So I always do at least it's a 10-minute headspace. But I actually use opportunities in my day to be mindful. So often in the car, I won't put the radio on, or as much as I love listening to your podcast, listen to podcasts, and I'll just have space and have quiet. And obviously I'm still doing something because I'm driving. You know, same for when I'm walking the dogs or eating a meal, or just to find an opportunity or opportunities in a day just to do something mindfully. I think is just even, you know, better than nothing, for sure.
Just quickly before we move on, another thing that I really liked was you talking about the favorite story that we have. And I definitely have a favorite story that pops up, one about my physical appearance and then another one about the future. It just has this habit of popping up. And I'm sure most people have something, don't they, that they tend to focus on, that's like this deep groove in the mind where the same thing pops up. So in terms of dealing with our favorite unhelpful story, what would you say?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing, as always, is to just be aware of it,
yeah,
and to identify it and to know what it is. So once you can do that, when it pops up, you can then recognize that. So you might have a name for your story. You know, some people like to have, you know, a name for their thinking mind, right? And so when your thinking mind's going on overdrive, you can use your name to be aware of that. And it's the same for a story, the I'm useless story, or I'm gonna mess this up story, I'm not good enough story, whatever it is. You can have fun names. It doesn't have to be a serious name. In fact, it's even better if it's a fun name, because it makes it, you know, less of a serious truth and more of just recognizing that it's your thinking mind again. So being aware of it, noticing it, and having some kind of name or something to recognize it when it pops up. And other people can help you with that, right? If you've got, you know, close friends, family, partners, when they hear it, they can also help you name it as well.
Yeah. And that naming it like diffuses it again. So this is another diffusion technique, I suppose. When you name it, you take some of the power out of it.
Yeah. So I think, So this is why it's a really interesting concept, because for some people, naming it, then it becomes like bigger and stronger and more pervasive. So that's when, you know, pairing it with some kind of diffusion could be really helpful. So recognizing it, naming it, and then having a technique like making light of it, making a joke of it, saying a word over and over again, taking that step back from it, then you can really start to recognize, okay, this really is just a story. For some people, even just noticing it might be enough. For some people, it's the notice and name. And then for some people, it's the notice, name, and I don't know, you can call it normalize. Just, you know, recognizing that that is your thinking mind at work and it is okay. Talking about it as well, I think, you know, massively helps. And I'm sure we'll come on to it. I do a bit of work in schools trying to, you know, get the message out there that your minds will be critical and negative and, you know, all of these things, and that is okay. Our minds all do it, and we don't have to try and stop that. Like we've said, there's various things that you can do to help and to be the person you want to be, even with those thoughts that happen.
Yes, absolutely, which is so powerful. Right, another chapter was called Accept Being Uncomfortable, and I found this really interesting when you talk about the pressure performance curve. So you've got your comfort zone, which we're all familiar with. Okay, stay small, stay on the couch, don't, you know, put yourself out there, that kind of thing. And, you know, we'll tend to feel pretty safe there. But the problem is we're, you know, missing out on opportunities. And then there's the next, it's like the stretch zone or something like that. You can clarify. Yeah. But what I thought was really interesting is that on the other side, so if you get into this stretch zone, you're going to feel a bit uncomfortable because you're putting yourself out there. You're getting out of your comfort zone. So you're going to have those doubting thoughts and feelings. And then what I hadn't considered as much until reading this in your book was around past that, which is the panic zone. And you say both the panic zone and the comfort zone, they're both avoidant, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, so this is where, you know, and our book is sort of focused on sport and performance. But if you're playing sport and you're wanting to, you know, perform at a high level, you are choosing to put yourself in a position where you might fail, where you might lose, where you might not get selected, where you might get injured. So inevitably with sport, but also, you know, look, life more generally, anything you do that's different from the norm, put yourself in that stretch zone where there's an element of pressure. And, you know, pressure is a whole really interesting topic, because why do we even see pressure as a bad thing? You know, pressure can be a really good thing, and it can really help our performance. But of course, there's a point there when our ability to manage that pressure becomes, you know, hampered, let's say. And like you say, then we go into the kind of panic zone, and that's where maybe our thinking mind has taken over, and we are, you know, really struggling to manage with the situation. But equally, like you say, in comfort zone, we, you know, part of my philosophy is, you know, go after what you want to in life, think big, dream big, and you know, figure out things to help you get there. So staying in your comfort zone is a way of avoiding those, you know, that panic zone, if you like. But it doesn't necessarily help you to be the person that you want to be or the person that you can be. So either end is an element of avoidance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of getting in the panic zone as being a form of avoidance. Comfort zone, obviously so, but it gave me some pause for thought. A lot of people are familiar with the comfort zone, but if people do tend to tip over into that panic, how would you rein that in with someone?
So it's a big question, because it, you know, it depends on a lot of things, but I think a lot of what we've spoken about in terms of awareness and diffusion are just great strategies for helping people to, okay, this emotion, because panic's partly an emotion, right? It's taking over me, flooding my body with all these different things. My thoughts are obviously playing into that. So let's just pause. Let's just see what's happening. Let's just take that step back. Physical and mental, both combined, right? So our thoughts have a massive impact on our body, on our physicality, but also vice versa. So doing something to either move your mind or move your body. Your body can be, you know, an element of breathing, relaxation, anything we've spoken about like that. And the mind aspect can be the diffusion strategies.
Mm. You spoke about the ways we avoid difficult thoughts and feelings. So there's distraction, opting out, thinking, and substances. I really like this, pairing them out and spreading them out into these different ways. We've all got a selection across all of them, I imagine, to varying degrees, but really identifying the way that we avoid discomfort. And as you say, it's our response to pressure or discomfort that is the problem, not the pressure and the discomfort themselves. And then asking yourself those questions, well, how's that working out for you? Perhaps if you're using alcohol, or, you know, rumination, overthinking, trying to get out of thinking with more thinking, that kind of thing. Asking yourself, you know, how's it working out for you? What's the cost? And are you open to trying something different? Which I thought, again, was such a lovely way of actually working through this. You just talk a bit about this.
Yeah, that might be a conversation that I would have with someone sort of at the start of working together. What's going on for you? What strategies do you try? How well is that working? And then would you be open to doing something different? Because I think it just helps people to realize, God, I really am trying hard here to not think that or to do this or to distract myself. And actually, yeah, it's not really working at all. Okay, would you be open to doing something different? Yeah, I would. So, you know, it's just a way of helping people to reflect on what they're trying, and actually attempts to control our thoughts are always pretty futile. And therefore, there is another way. And then that's, you know, just a nice link into it.
You say that acceptance is a willful act, which I thought was interesting, because actually, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but at the same time, to me, acceptance is also kind of stopping doing something, because actually to resist something, you've got to be actively resisting it, albeit perhaps unconsciously, by saying, oh, I don't want this, essentially. But you're saying, even though that may be true at the deepest level, you still need to practice it.
Yeah, it's so interesting writing a book. I'm sure you found this, because you have to put down into words and black and white, like concepts that are really quite difficult.
Absolutely, particularly with this kind of stuff, which is profound.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think, like, in a way, I totally see what you mean. Acceptance is sort of removing resistance, right? And kind of just allowing that and stepping back from it. But I suppose in the way that we were trying to describe it, it's not just a passive, like, oh, I'll just put up with it. Acceptance is genuinely opening up and making space for the difficult thoughts and feelings. And it's very different to just trying to ignore or trying to put up with them. So I think there's just a willful act to genuinely make space for, and that takes like all of this stuff, right? It takes practice, because it's very different to putting up with or trying to ignore. And there's, you know, lots of things that you can do, to strategies and tools and things and act to kind of help to create that space and realize that there is space for those thoughts. And it's not that you want them, but there's a capacity to accept and welcome them, if you like. And that, again, there's another sort of fundamental shift there, once you realize that it's not that you're choosing to have them or that you want them, but you also don't have to try and get rid of them. And the energy that we might expend in trying to do that, we can then put to much better use once we get into this idea of acceptance.
Yeah, I remember back in the day when I used to try and change my thoughts. There was one particular day and I was covering a football match, and I'd been doing it for a long period. And I remember suddenly I was on a platform on the underground, and literally I ran out of energy. I was like, oh, I can't do it anymore. This kind of trying to change it. And it gets to that point, doesn't it? It does take up a hell of a lot of energy. And this is a much, I think, more constructive long-term way of being able to deal with these things that are not going to go away, because you're not wrestling with them. And and I loved your wrinkly sock exercise. And I went for a run yesterday, and I had my shorts on, and you know when the knot gets like really tight and you have to sort of unpick it anyway, and my shorts were just a little bit loose, and I was sort of having to pull them up, and I did stop and eventually unpick this knot and do it tighter. But next time that happens, I am going to think, like, nope, I'm going to put up with these droopy shorts for the whole run. But I thought this was lovely.
Yeah, again, it's just another like practical, tangible thing that you can do, is whenever you're experiencing some kind of discomfort. And in the book, we use the example of a wrinkly sock, which is annoying. Like, no one's going to choose to have a wrinkly sock. It's really irritating. You can be so frustrated with this wrinkly sock, and all your energy and attention is on the wrinkly sock, and actually you flipping don't spend the time thinking or doing what you want to be doing. Or you can just choose to really accept that wrinkly sock. You can choose to welcome that wrinkly sock. You can choose to think about how the wrinkles feel on your feet, and you can choose to just simply like notice it being there and be okay with that. And it's just such a different experience to the one where you're trying to push it away. You can do it with something like an itch. It's quite difficult to do. Mm-hmm. Can you sit there and watch and notice your itch? Of course, the easy thing to do is to scratch the itch. But if we're practicing this technique, we'll be there watching it, noticing it, and just trying to welcome that sensation and that feeling. And then, of course, something like an itch will pass. And it's amazing to practice that. And then another thing, I think it's Stephen Hayes talks about, is urge surfing, like just noticing something, watching that urge and watching it pass. Acceptance just fundamentally changes the... It doesn't change the situation. It changes how you feel in that situation.
Yeah. No, I love that. And it gives, I suppose, that opportunity when tricky moments come to actually be like, oh, this is good. This is a chance for me to practice something. Here's something that's annoying. Let's say an inner experience, or like you say, a wrinkly sock or shorts that are falling down when you're running. And actually it becomes an opportunity to strengthen your acceptance muscle, totally. Which I thought... Exactly. Which is
another
wonderful.
Good one is when you're driving and let's say you're in a little bit of a rush and you come to a red traffic light. Now nobody wants a red traffic light. Everybody's pretty much trying to get to where they want to get to as quickly as they can, and you can sit there and be absolutely fuming with this red traffic light, and you can be having your feet on the accelerator and the clutch and almost like revving to get ready for as soon as it goes amber. Or you can choose that in that moment that is what's happened, and almost just to like use that opportunity as 10 or 20 seconds of pause to accept that that is the situation, to use that opportunity for something, and then when it goes green, to then move off. And that your journey is so different. You know, the agitation that you can feel with road rage and traffic versus one where you can just use that as an opportunity.
I love what you, I didn't know that Stephen had spoken about urge surfing. Yes, I
it
mean,
might
I get
Russ Harris. I don't want to misquote.
Okay, well, Russ or Stephen, they're both, okay, ACT powerhouses.
Both legends, yeah.
Yeah, but I love that, yes. Noticing that urge too. For example, the obvious one would be scrolling or pick up your mobile phone. Mm-hmm. To notice that urge and instead of wrestling with it, recognize it's a chance to develop this kind of thing.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Two more from this one, I think, just quickly. The yes-no exercise. So it's like saying yes to experiences as opposed to no to experience. And then the other one, I'm not sure if this is from this section or not, but as I said to you before we started recording, this is one I've already been doing this morning, which is to do things like at half speed, which is bloody hard.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So the yes-no is, and again, this can be perceived as a little bit of a crazy one, but if you can go with it, it's actually really powerful. It's to, as wherever you're sat now listening to this, just like look around and look at things and say yes to those things. So there's a coat hanging on the coat peg. In fact, first of all, sorry, you look around and you say no to things, and you say, I wish you weren't there. That is so annoying. Like, can you be different? I wish you were blue and not pink, or, you know, I wish that was tidy or not the way it is. And just almost like criticize whatever you can see in your environment. And it feels quite, you know, when you do this exercise with people, you can kind of see the tension in their body, or you can sense it in their tone. And then the flip side of that is looking around at things and saying, do you know what? Actually, I quite like you there. Yeah, I'm gonna be happy with you there. And actually, yeah, you look pretty good as you are right there. I think that's a good place for you to be. And just like, again, just like going around the room and like saying yes to things. And obviously, it's a practice. You know, you can do as you're sat here and here and now. But obviously, you can take that then to wider context. And when you just miss the tube doors, or when you know someone says something to you that's slightly irritating, or when something happens where you don't want it to happen, again, it's an opportunity, right? Do we wish that thing hadn't happened, or can we use that acceptance and go, yes, it's happened, and you know your internal experience to that situation is just so different if you can say yes to that.
And internal experiences, that's where it becomes really challenging, right? Let's say we have a feeling of anxiety. The impulse then is, oh, I want to get away from that. And that, for me, has been in the past quite often, like go up into my head or distract, reach for the phone, reach for something else. Actually, no, say yes to this sensation in your body that you want it to be there, but you're actually welcoming it And that transforms your relation to it and can even transform it, although that's not really the point, but it can lead it there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, again, take that into a sporting context, and that's transformational. You know, that feeling, that kind of churning of your stomach, we interpret that as, oh, no, I'm nervous. Oh, no, that probably means I'm going to play badly. Actually, what if we just flip that around and go, yes, here it is. Here's that, yeah, here's that flipping of the stomach. Like, that means I care. That means I'm ready. That means this is important.
Yeah,
it's that acceptance piece which changes it.
I did this with a run recently, actually, and I was just getting back into fitness after injury, and, you know, I was in pain going up a hill, and I was doing that. Yes, pain. Yes, pain. I'll feel better later. It can absolutely transform it. What was the other one I mentioned?
You said doing things at half pace.
Oh, yeah, this is brilliant. Go on.
Yeah, which covers, I mean, it covers loads of them, right? But, you know, particularly in terms of if you want to just be mindful, be aware, is just slowing down. I think it's, we spoke before about how it's so easy in life just to go through things quickly, as quickly as you can, from one thing to the next. And, you know, a big part of accepting is that awareness piece. And just doing things slowly means that you've got an opportunity to recognize that space, to see that gap, and to be more mindful in what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do.
It is.
That's probably the one that I find the hardest, because I do tend to do things at full speed. But it can just be like, you know, again, we're not, the expectation isn't that this is done all day, every day. It's just like little opportunities just to slow down. And just have that opportunity to watch your thoughts.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm absolutely going to embrace this one. I'm like you. My natural inclination, or perhaps my learned inclination, is to hurry and rush. I've got to get this done. And even going up the stairs. Okay, I'm going to walk really slowly up the stairs. And actually, I'm sure, you know, when you don't rush and hurry in that way, things get done and of a better quality. So I think this is really valuable. You know, I eat my dinner definitely too fast, so I'm going to try this one tonight.
But you'll notice how agitated your mind gets at you doing it. Like, this is such a waste of time. Why am I going slowly? You know, and that's, again, it's a great opportunity to notice your mind at work, your thinking mind, because so many of those thoughts will crop up.
Okay, just quickly on the values piece. So the whole thing about ACT is doing what you need to do irrespective of the uncomfortable thoughts and feelings, letting go of the wrestle, as you say, you know, dropping the struggle fundamentally. And so just quickly talk about the values piece. And just before you get into it, I just want to suggest, like, fundamentally what we all want is to feel content, fulfilled, those kind of things. Like, that's what we all want fundamentally. But then on top of that, it will be different for people.
Yeah, is that for sure. Fair? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I think, like, a big part of ACT is taking action in the direction that you want to go in your life. So to do that, you have to figure out where you want to go in your life and what's important to you. So, a big you know, piece of work that I would do with anyone who I'm working with is you know, what is the fundamental parts of life that are important to you? And so, for example, you can get people to think about when you retire and you have your retirement party, or when you have your 50th birthday, or whatever it is, 20th if you're working with a young person. And there's a few people that stand up and they say a few words about you. And I want you to think about not just, you know, what they say in terms of your achievements, they're great, but what do you want them to say in terms of the person that you are, or the person that you were, or the impact that they had on you, you had on them. And that can just really help people to tap into, I suppose, something beyond just the achievements and more about how they want to choose to live their life. And then you've got, you know, an ability when you've got a difficult decision to make, or you're going about your day and you've got, you know, a direction that you could take one of two paths. And if you're aware of, and you can tap into what's important to me, it just becomes a lot easier to then live your life via that and make decisions that take you towards the person that you want to be rather than away from the person that you want to be. You know, so for a good example might be, you know, let's go kind of back to the sporting arena. I know that you worked a lot with the hockey girls, right? Or you've you know, done some research around them, and they wanted to inspire a nation.
Mm. Oh, I thought this was wonderful. Yeah, it was about being overdoing fundamentally, wasn't it?
So you know, it's just, you know, a really nice thing to do. So let's imagine that I've got selected. It's my first opportunity to play for GB, and I'm feeling so nervous. In fact, that I'm almost wondering whether I want to do this. Like, it'd be so much easier for me to just not do it and just pretend I'm ill or to pull a hamstring or something. And actually, if I can tap back into like what's really important to me on this journey, which is to inspire other people, then what's the direction that would take me towards that? It's to go in and play this match. And then I can, have that sort of conversation with myself. I want to take that step towards it rather than away from it. And an easy option would be to, feign an injury or an illness. Then I don't have to avoid, I don't have to face into those difficult thoughts and feelings. But if I know what's important to me and I know what my values are, then I know that, it's more easy for me to access good decisions to take me towards the person that I want to be.
Yeah, I love this about the 2016 squad. I remember in 2012, their vision was around winning gold. And I think there was still an inspiration piece. So that was it was about a thing. Whereas in 2016, it was what be the difference, inspire the future, recognize the past. It's not that, but it's something along those lines. And I thought it was so lovely because it was such a being thing and it was serving something bigger than themselves. And I'm sure that was a massive, massive part that enabled them to produce such an incredible performance in 2016. There was that selflessness element to their victory that I thought, really speaks to even what you said at the beginning about wanting to help other people. Like, they were kind of doing that through sport, and I think it gave them such a power, which is why I absolutely love that story. Right, so you've spoken about all these different things. And as I said, the wonderful thing I think about your book and looking about this, and it's been such a good reminder for me, is that you can pass out and spread out this, okay, aware mind, observing mind, and thinking mind, and take it into acceptance and dropping the struggle and playing in the now and doing what matters, and there are all these different sort of techniques in there. Yet you can fold it back up, because all of the things we've spoken about, not struggling, so a lack of resistance fundamentally, accepting being uncomfortable, acceptance, playing in the now, so presence, and then doing what matters, so the quality of your being, those are all traits of the aware mind or the observing mind. And this is what I think is so interesting again about this, when you really consider it on a deep level, is it's like a shift in identity. Is the more that we can, and I'm interested to hear what you think about this, but the more we can realize that actually this observing mind is more fundamentally who we are than the thinking mind. And on that level, we're the same as and no better than or no worse than anyone else. And we have this innate capacity for acceptance and presence and all this stuff. So it's around a shift in identity. And it is this paradoxical element of, okay, yes, we can play around and act with all these things, but it comes down to, quite simply again, observing mind and thinking mind and the difference between them, and shifting from the thinking mind, which we've become familiar with, back into our original true identity, you could say.
Yeah, look, it's so fascinating, isn't it? All this aware mind and self and who's I, and
there's
some great work I remember reading by Byron Katie, who talks about like your name. If you think about your name, and actually how to you your name is the truth. But if we go back to, okay, well, where did you get your name from? Well, I got it from my parents. They named it to me. Okay, well, how do you know like that's true? And I'm like, well, if you can question really everything about your identity and reality. But I think, like fundamentally, once you strip it all back, you've got that sense of awareness, which is your true self, isn't it?
Yeah.
And our thinking mind is all the stuff that we've been, we've learned over the years, our background, our experiences play into that, how we grew up and all the, different things that set in the senses that we've had over the years. But when you strip it all back, the true self behind it all.
And that true self, which is just this aware, accepting, open presence, isn't different in me than it is in you, than it is in anyone. And so I think what I love about this recognition is then that sense of treating others like yourself becomes much easier, because you recognize on this level, at least, you are the same as the other person. So of course you're going to treat people in that way, as opposed to the thinking mind, which is all about judgment and comparison and conceptualization and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we're in this body, right? And like you're you, and I'm me, and I've got my body, and you've got yours. But yeah, behind it all, we are. There's a sense of humanity behind, you know, that's shared across all of us, and it's so easy to forget it because we get so absorbed up, don't we, into our worlds and our lives. But you know, I talk a little bit about compassion in the book, but if you can go back to this, you know, fundamental shared humanity between all of us, it helps so much with being compassionate for other people, even when people have done something that you don't like or have said something that, you know, makes you angry. Underneath it all is, you know, is this humanity that we all share.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. Right, I want to ask you a bit about you then, because, by the way, Drop the Struggle, fantastic book, highly recommended, so get it. And I'll link to it in the show notes. But just to then come back to your own experience. So obviously you're an elite hockey player. I know you've trained for an ultra, you've climbed to Everest base camp. So you're a real doer. And then we chatted before we started recording a while back, and you told me about going on a Vipassana retreat, which is like hardcore meditation. So what was it, like 10 days, like meditating like 14 hours a day or something like that. And you said it was harder than an ultra. So can you just talk a bit about what that was like and why, for example, it was harder than ultra? Because, you know, on the face of it, it's just sitting there for long periods of time. But yes, it, you know, compared to an ultra, which is doing to the nth degree, whereas this is being to the nth degree.
Yeah, totally. Like, so it was the same year I did an Ironman triathlon and Vipassana, which is a 10-day silent retreat. People often ask me, like, why did you do that? And I suppose the Ironman and the training for the Ironman was what I knew. It was, you know, setting yourself a goal and working hard to achieve it. And that's, you know, for me, that was in my comfort zone. Okay, there was definitely times when you'd have to go out on a, you know, 6-hour bike ride that was stretching. But it's kind of what I knew and what I was comfortable with. And obviously, training for hockey, you know, you've got your structure, you've got your goals, and you're working towards it. And the Vipassana thing, I'd sort of heard about it, and it kept coming up over a period of a few years, and I became more and more intrigued by it, and I became more aware of how my desire and my drive to be productive and to achieve things was great in one sense, and was, you know, causing me difficulties in another sense, because it just meant that I found it really difficult to just be with myself, to be with people. And I actually really wanted to explore that ability. And I thought, well, there's no better way to do it than to kind of throw myself in at the deep end. So went on this retreat. It was literally a few months after I did the Ironman. And you start the day at 4 a.m. and you're silent for 10 days. You don't even make eye contact with people. Your last meal is at 11:30 a.m. So there's all sorts of ways that it challenges you, but fundamentally you spend a lot of your day sitting, meditating. So, but when I say meditating, it's essentially observing your breath, which is what you do for the first 3 days, and then beyond that you observe the sensations in your body. So it's, you know, I guess an interesting kind of meditation, but you're forced to just be. You know, you're in an environment where there literally are no distractions. And I mean, there were so many things I took from that experience, but fundamentally, like, I think one of the crazy things, and when I was reflecting, just coming onto this podcast about it, is, and we were just talking there about your physical self. So we see ourselves as our physical self as a pretty solid structure, right? But after you've sat and watched your sensations in your body for 10 days, you notice how you are just made up of subatomic particles. So every single, you know, part of your skin is just a tiny little atom that is, you know, next to another one, and they're all vibrating and moving. So we don't wake up one day and become old. We are changing all of the time. And after 10 days, you can sit and you can feel, literally, you can feel the particles moving in your body. And it's a crazy sensation. But what I was talking about earlier in terms of intellectually knowing something and then experientially feeling something, I think that's what Vipassana gave me, was the experience of watching sensations come and go, knowing that nothing lasts forever, recognizing that there's so much contentment in just being, you know, in those 10 days. And don't get me wrong, it was for the first 5 days, I think I said to you, it was definitely one of the hardest things, because for us to sit and you know, there's no notes, there's obviously no phones, there's no books, you can't you know, do any kind of stimulation. So that is incredibly difficult, especially for, you know, people like us who just like to do. But after maybe day five, probably day six, you get to a point where, or I got to a point where it just became so peaceful.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, that sort of, I guess that inner mind, inner sort of thinking mind did, you know, not through me trying to, but it did quieten down. And, you know, you become so aware of your thoughts and sensations. It's an amazing experience.
Have you retained some of that heightened awareness?
I sometimes try and go back to that. I think not that place where I got to and in feeling the sensations. I think that did require like really dedicated work for those 10 days. But certainly I've retained, the experience, the kind of, yeah, that deep experiential knowledge I got from it in terms of watching sensations, watching thoughts. And being able to take that step back from it. I mean, that environment was the place to really hone those skills for sure.
Did you have any enlightenment moments where you saw through the illusory nature of the self?
Well, they say, I didn't have an experience, but they say that some people like burst out crying have this unbelievable path. I definitely had moments where, because the other thing with sitting for that long period is it's really painful, like physically it's so painful. So I definitely had experience where I was in so much pain, and you watch it and you see the pain and then you see it pass. And it is an amazing experience to realize how, you know what is pain. It's created by the mind and, all these different thoughts that come and go. And it is just... I suppose it's an experience where it's very difficult to put it into words because it's at the fundamental, like, experiential level. But if anyone's remotely curious about it, I personally think we should all do it once in our lives, sit in silence for 10 days. I think this world would be a very different place if we all did it.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly encouraged to do it more. In fact, the thing that puts me off is actually what you've just said. Well, apart from my family and getting away from them for 10 days, I'm not sure I'd be given that pass, particularly with a bubby on the scene now, but is the way you sit, because I've got a bit of a dodgy hip and back and stuff like that from my tennis days, because you have to sit on a cushion, right? And sort of
if you've got like medical issues, you can sit on a chair.
Oh, good. So I could have the chair.
You could get exemption. I'm sure there'd still be pain related sitting in a chair for that long, but yeah, you sit on the floor cross-legged, done that for 5 minutes, it really hurts. So for 14 hours a day, it's very uncomfortable, but you do get used to it. Like anything, it's amazing that you get used to it.
Where did you do it?
So there's two centres in the UK, one in Suffolk and the one I did was in Herefordshire.
Right. And no one sort of went bananas?
Nobody went bananas. There was a few people who left, for sure.
Were there? Right.
Yeah.
And then on the
it's like I say, it's pretty tough. But on the last day, you're allowed to talk. So there's this unbelievable experience on that last day where you've spoken to the people who you've like been in an environment with for 10 days. That is a kind of crazy day, or it's not even a day, a few hours, where you kind of share the experience that you've had. Then you do one last meditation. There was a few giggles and various things in that one, but otherwise it's all very silent.
What has it taught you about then the difference between doing and being? And as you said, if everyone did this, the world would be a better place, because, you know, culturally such doers, aren't we? People talk about feeling guilty if they're not doing something, and we're all rushing around and got to pay the bills and, you know, cost of living and da, 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 da. It's just doing. And so what have you learned about it and actually bringing some of that being into your life?
I mean, I think at like a very simple level, I learned that being is as good as doing. And I'll pause there because I want to say almost, you know, it's better than doing. Doing is great and it feels productive and it's like amazing things that obviously you can achieve. But just being is amazing as well. And I try and bring that into it frustrates my husband sometimes because he's a doer and he's always doing. And, you know, especially with having a little baby, I've really valued just being with her. And previously, I think that would have frustrated me because you know what it's like. You can't be very productive at all when you've got a little baby around. And I found it so much more enjoyable now that I see that value in just being. And by just being, I mean literally not having to do anything, not having to get my feeling of value from being productive in a day. So I can still feel myself, I can still feel content, I can still feel valuable even if I haven't done anything that day, if I've literally just, you know, just been with whoever I've been with. But it's, you know, simple things as well, like you mentioned insomnia earlier. I really struggled with sleep before, and that pretty much like changed my experience with sleep. You know, I previously thought that I had to physically tire myself out basically to get to sleep at night. You don't do exercise for 10 days, you literally sit in one place. But I slept as good as I've ever slept because I gave my mind that space. So yeah, I think back to your question, which was something along the lines of you know, some of the things I took from it. But I think, you know, going back to that piece around humanity as well, once you're sat in a group, and you are, there's like, you know, 60 women and 60 men, so it's a huge group of people. But once you're sat next to people and you realize we are all made up of the same thing and we are all having the same fundamental experience here, it has allowed me to be a lot more compassionate for other people as well.
Wonderful. And I suppose it allows you to recognize our innate enoughness, which is so important, right? Because I think so much striving comes from a place of trying to become enough, but actually in being, you are enough.
Yeah. And it's this, you know, it's this amazing balance and almost like a bit of a paradox, because we want a world where people are striving to achieve. And, you know, we wouldn't see the amazing Djokovic Nadal matches if they didn't have that desire to achieve. Like that in itself is great. But I think, and the reason I said I think it would be valuable for everyone to do it, is because I think we also have to realize that being enough, being just us, just being is enough. That innate enoughness, as you say. So I think, yeah, it's the combination of two, which is the recipe for contentment, I think.
I agree with that, because I think the scales are too far tipped onto the doing side. And I think you see that with mass consumption and what's happening with the planet. I think that's a reflection of that to a degree. And just finally then to finish, because we touched on enoughness, your moonshot series that you do with Katie, because I love this. Like, and my sense is that, you know, you're really trying to put out there this message of enoughness and people recognizing that it is innate, and then from that place trying to go out and do what you want to do. And by all means, set, like, I know you're a big fan of the most lofty goal possible, you're that definitely that type of person, but come from a place of you're already enough. Express that. Don't expect that to make you enough, because that's a trap.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, like, everything that we've spoken about on this podcast, when we work with athletes or business people, whoever it is, one of the things that we hear, or Katie and I heard a lot, was, I wish I'd learned this earlier. How different things would have been if I'd have known this earlier. So it was kind of lockdown time, and we thought, why don't we try and make this a reality? Like, why don't we try and get these messages to young people as early as possible in their life, to as many people as possible? We kind of had this vision of, you know, transforming mental health in this country, maybe in, you know, globally, by helping people to understand some of these things really early on, before they get into some of the really unhelpful mind patterns that we get into. So we set up the Moonshot series, which is essentially that it's an online course taking all these principles into schools to teach people earlier in life about all this amazing stuff, which I think, I know I'm biased, but I'm sure you agree, like, can really transform the way you live.
100%.
And the way that you are, but also the way that you impact other people.
Yeah, well, I think you've summed it up beautifully. I think it's a really beautiful intention, what you and Katie are doing. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of Katie's, and I'm a huge fan of yours as well now, Jenna, as well. And so your book is called Drop the Struggle, A Transformative Approach to Achieving Your Potential in Sport and Life. And where else can people find out about the wonderful work you're doing?
Well, good question. So, I mean, we were talking about social media before this call. I actually try and stay off social media as much
good
as I
idea.
Can. Because, yeah, I just honestly think it's the root of a lot of problems. So it's funny, I have this sort of tension between I know that I could spread really good things on social media, but I also see the harm it creates. So I tend to just try and stay off it. But moondropseries.co.uk, you can find out a little bit more about me, about Katie, about what we're up to as well.
Wonderful. Well, listen, Jenna, loved the book, and I've loved being with you for the last however long we've been together. It's been a real joy just being and connecting, and really, really enjoyed it. So thanks so much for coming on.
Awesome. Thanks, Simon, for having me.
Thank you for listening to this conversation with Jenna Ashford. Please do keep your emails and messages coming. The best way is via my website, simonmundy.com. And if you would consider sharing this episode, I would be very grateful.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.